Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. We welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. All three of our interviews today are related in some way or another to this very important day on the calendar, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Thrilled to be spending this portion of the morning show with a best-selling author by the name of Wendy Holden, who has written a number of compelling books, the most recent of which is called Born Survivors, Three Young Mothers and Their Extraordinary Story of Courage, Defiance, and Hope. This is a Holocaust story unlike any you have ever heard before, in which three young women imprisoned in a concentration camp did all that they could to conceal their own pregnancies, knowing that were their pregnancies to be known to their captors, it would mean almost certain death for themselves and for their as-yet unborn children. And only by the slimmest of margins were they able to escape that all-but-certain death sentence and give birth under unspeakable circumstances to their young children, to their babies who managed to survive and who are alive to this day and who are, in a sense, the last leg of this incredible story told by Wendy Holden. Her book is published by HarperCollins, and Wendy Holden is coming to the Lake Geneva Public Library for a special presentation Saturday, May 14th at 10:30 in the morning, a presentation that not only will focus on this story and the book about it, but will also feature sons of some of the liberators of that particular concentration camp. And as a matter of fact, an invitation has been extended to a couple of those surviving infants as well. It's an amazing story. And Wendy Holden, who is joining me via telephone from her home in England, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg, and thank you very much for having me.
So how did you first become aware of this extraordinary story?
Well, the mothers would say, and the babies would all say, that luck plays an enormous part in their story, and it certainly plays an enormous part in mine. I was reading something late at night online. It was an obituary in a Canadian newspaper, and it featured a woman who had died, who had been in Auschwitz and had a baby there, who had died in childbirth. So I was very moved by her story, and it occurred to me that in all the books I'd read about the Holocaust, I'd never read anything before that featured children who'd survived the camps, and I then realized or thought that that was because there couldn't be any. Obviously, you know, most mothers and babies were murdered by the Nazis and sent to the gas chambers or worse in very many ways, and I just couldn't quite fathom that any could have survived. I looked online in case there was anything about them anywhere, and my name came across, my eyes came across the name Eva Clark. And she was an English survivor, coming up to 70 years old. And my second piece of luck was that she lived 1 hour from me in Cambridge in England. And I went and spent a day with her. She agreed to see me. We had a very emotional, beautiful day together, laughing and crying. And at the end of it, I told her that I believed her story to be unique and that I would really love to have the privilege of writing it in a book. And she reached out and touched my arm and told me she'd been waiting for me for nearly 70 years. And then she laughed and told me that she thought that she also thought her story to be unique. She'd gone through most of her life, 65 years in fact, thinking she was the only baby who could have survived. And it was only in 2010, again by luck, that she discovered that there were two other babies whose mothers had been on the self-same journey as her mother. So all three mothers were young Jewish mothers from Europe, from Czechoslovakia and from Poland. And they'd all have individually been sent to Auschwitz to be examined by Dr. Joseph Mengele, the angel of death. And from that moment on, their journeys were the same right up until their liberation in the final camp. But each story is individual and remarkable in its own right, and each of them is a miracle. It's an incredible event that these babies were born and that they survived and that their mothers survived as well.
Hmm. One of the starkest, most heartrending images that we're given is this image of women herded together. I mean, the prisoners in that camp who were women, herded together and examined in the most inhumane way to try and detect if indeed any of them were pregnant. Because, of course, in the mind of the collective mind of the Nazis, it made no sense to allow a Jewish woman to give birth to what would amount to yet another Jewish person coming into the world. So
absolutely, yes, absolutely. They were. It was their intent to eradicate the entire Jewish race. So certainly they wouldn't want another Jewish baby born, as they would put it. But also at that point, and again, luck then comes into it again, because it was towards the end of the war. It was summer to fall 1944. And by then, the Nazis desperately needed slave labor, because all the men had been sent to the front. They were losing the war left, right, and center, and they had terrible experience on the Russian front and so on. So they were desperate for slave labor. Anybody they could, who was able-bodied, would be sent to the factories to work, to try and carry on making armaments and so on. So all three mothers individually, not together in the same group, but individually, had an identical experience, which was that having got to Auschwitz, having been sort of disgorged from the train into this place on which they described as Dante's Inferno, or Hell on Earth, they were then marched to what's called the bathhouse, the sauna, and they were there stripped and shaved of every hair, and all their clothing taken away, all their jewelry stolen. And then they were marched outside and forced to stand naked and shivering on a parade ground, standing in cold, wet clay for hours and hours on end while they were inspected and examined. And Joseph Mengele, who was in charge of Auschwitz II Birkenau, which was the women's camp, took a special pride in personally examining these women, to the point that he even worked on his days off. And individually he approached each woman, each of these three mothers, and asked if they were pregnant, and he said it in such a way that was quite chilling. He said, "Are you pregnant, pretty lady?" And they each denied it, because they were only 2 months pregnant, and they weren't yet showing. But the ones that he suspected were either lying or were already pregnant, he would either squeeze their breasts very hard to see if they produced any milk, which might betray them, or if they were very visibly present, they were pregnant, they were immediately pulled out of the line and shoved into a corner where they would later have been either sent to the gas chambers or sent to his experimentation wing, where he conducted the most unspeakable experiments on mothers and babies, particularly on twins.
Mm. It's hard to fathom such evil. And it's one of those stories, too, in which we sort of think that we have heard already the darkest chapters of this story, and then something like this comes to light that is in some ways more unspeakable still. Tell us about the process by which you uncovered each of these stories, and all the detail that surrounds these stories, because of course the surviving children are not in the best perspective of offering those stories up unless they heard them from their own parents. Tell us about how sort of the legacy of these stories was preserved, and how ultimately you were able to find out all that you did.
Well, I was very fortunate, because each of the mothers had not only told their children and others about their experiences, including each mother gave evidence to the Shoah Foundation, so they were recorded on video online, which I was able to view. So that was wonderful for me, because I was able to see them talking and speaking and gesticulating and smiling and crying a little, and all these different aspects of their expressions and their mannerisms that it was extraordinary and wonderful for me to be able to witness, because obviously they'd all just died or previously died. In fact, one mother, Eva's mother, Anka, had only died 6 months before I came to the story. So I was lucky to have that. I was lucky to have written testimony. They had written things down for their family members, and they had also given interviews to researchers which were in the archives. It took me 18 months in total to write and research the book, and it probably would have taken me 5 years, Greg, if I'd had a sort of unlimited deadline. But from the moment I met Eva, I realized that the book had to be published on the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War and the 70th anniversary of their liberation, which would also, of course, coincide roughly with their 70th birthdays. So I went to each of the sites mentioned in the book. I started in Auschwitz-Birkenau. I went to each of their birthplaces, their hometowns. I visited each of their graves, including one in Nashville, Tennessee. And I went to Auschwitz-Birkenau. I also went to Freiburg, where they had the slave labor camp, where they were incarcerated for 7 months making aircraft parts and were virtually starved and worked to death, where each of them in that 7 months went down to 70 pounds and ultimately gave birth to 3-pound babies. So there was a great wealth of material, archive material. The Nazis were very thorough with their documentation, so they had records and names, and I was able to access the archives. I was also able to access the archive material at the concentration camp, where they were finally liberated by the 11th Armored Division under General Patton on the 5th of May 1945, and the Austrians had kept all the documents and done a marvelous job at keeping that concentration camp as a working memorial to what happened there. And just going back to your earlier point, yes, it is unspeakable what happened to them, but there's a lot of very wonderful things in this book, and I always came at it from the happy ending. My first point of contact was a living baby, all of them will be, by the very nature of their ages, the last known survivors of the Holocaust. And they are full of life and vitality. They're all working. Mark Olsky is a doctor in Madison, Wisconsin. Eva, as I said, lives near me in Cambridge, England, and she speaks to school children 4 or 5 days a week as part of the Holocaust Educational Trust. And Hannah Berger-Moran lives in California and has a company. She's a biochemist, and she has a company that tests drugs for cancer. So their contribution has been enormous, and they've gone on to have children and grandchildren. They are full of joy, full of vitality. And so coming to the story from that perspective, and then looking back, and also in the course of the journey that they went on, their mothers went on, I was able to come across extraordinary acts of courage and kindness by complete strangers who risked everything to help them, and which ultimately helped save their lives. And so although it is another Holocaust book, it has this incredibly redemptive quality. And as we've traveled the world together, because this book's been published now in 21 countries and translated into 16 languages, people come away having met them with this sense of incredible optimism and incredible hope and a reaffirmation of the human spirit.
Absolutely. And we should say that all three women went on to, in many ways, flourish in a way that it seems truly miraculous now. I mean, even beyond the matter of managing to successfully deliver their babies, but then to go on to leave productive and really surprisingly happy lives, a couple of them remarrying and all of them experiencing many of life's joys, which in and of itself is also an important facet of this story of redemption, as you put it.
Yes, very much so. And as Hannah said, we had very big shoes to fill. You know, they didn't remember anything. Of course, they were born in various unspeakable circumstances in different parts of the Nazi extermination system. And it's absolutely miraculous that they survived. But they were raised with the ethos that they had to do something special with their lives. They had to take that opportunity at life that they'd been given that so many millions hadn't, and do something extraordinary with it, and most of all, enjoy it. And that's exactly what they've done. And they are extraordinary. And when I come to speak in Lake Geneva, I will be accompanied by Dr. Mark Olsky, who is an ER doctor from Madison, Wisconsin. And I shall also be accompanied by Larry Kosiek. And Larry is an extraordinary man, too. He is the son of the young American liberator, Albert J. Kosiek, who liberated all three mothers and the babies, along with something like 80,000 other prisoners. Unsuspectingly, he came across this concentration camp, not knowing what it was, not even really knowing about concentration camps. And he asked, he was told, he was flagged down by a Red Cross doctor who begged him and his small little reconnaissance unit of 26 men, they begged him to come up the hill and liberate the camp because he believed, the doctor believed, that the Nazis were going to try and exterminate all of the last prisoners to eradicate the evidence. And Albert Kosiek radioed to his command and he asked for permission to go to the camp and he was denied it. He was told that it was very important that he carry on checking the state of the bridges because the rest of the 11th Armored Division was coming through. And Albert Kosiek turned to his men and said, looks like we're going to disobey orders.
Wow.
And they went up the hill and he personally, aged I think 26 years old, liberated all these people including the three mothers and the babies. And when I was doing my research and I came across his name, I desperately wanted to know more about him. I wanted to know the legacy of what that must have been like to have seen that as a young man, having gone through the Battle of the Bulge already and seen so much. And I was able to speak to him via the wonders of the internet, and he sent me photographs. He also sent me handwritten testimony that his father had written that he'd never shown anybody before, which I was able to incorporate in the book. And so it's Larry that has a place in Lake Geneva, and it's Larry that's invited me, and I'm very, very happy and proud to stand alongside him because one of the greatest joys of my entire research process was to, when we launched the hardback of the book in the Illinois Holocaust Museum in May last year, I was able to introduce the three babies to the sons of of Albert Kosiek, and so the survivors met the sons of the liberator, which was an extraordinary moment. And we also actually have Brian Peterson with us, and Brian Peterson is the son of Dr. Pete Peterson, who was in that group that arrived at the camp after Albert Kosiek and his reconnaissance division had liberated the camp. He arrived at the camp, and it was he that first ever came across one of these babies, and it was he came across Hannah, who was the lovely lady who now lives in California. And he took one look at her, this pitiful scrap of a child who was probably close to death and covered in sores and riddled with infection. And he whisked her away and operated on her and saved her life. And Hannah was able independently to find Dr. Peterson and make contact with him before he died. And she's now very much a part of Brian and his family's life, and they also live in Illinois. So we have a very strong Illinois connection, and we're very, very happy to come back.
Wow. That just enhances what will be a very powerful visit for you at the Lake Geneva Public Library on Saturday, May 14th. A last quick question. My understanding is that these three mothers, Rachel, Anka, Priska, did not know one another.
They didn't know one another. They never knew each other, which was, I think, a great pity, because I think they could have been of great comfort to each other. But the need for secrecy was so vital, so important, that they didn't tell anybody they were pregnant. And Rachel, who was accompanied by her three sisters throughout the entire 7 months of her pregnancy and shared a bunk with one sister, even the sisters didn't know she was pregnant. That's how important it was to keep it secret.
Wow. Wendy Holden's, her book is Born Survivors, Three Young Mothers and Their Extraordinary Story of Courage, Defiance, and Hope. Wendy Holden appears at the Lake Geneva Public Library on Saturday morning, May 15th at 10:30 in the morning. One of the special guests who will be joining author Wendy Holden at the event at the Lake Geneva Public Library on Saturday, May 15th, is Larry Kosiek. It was his father, Albert Kosiek, then a 28-year-old U.S. Army sergeant who led his platoon of 23 men into Mauthausen prison camp to liberate its prisoners. That liberation took place on this very date, the 5th of May, back in 1945. Here is a portion of my conversation with Larry Kosiak, recounting what his father experienced on that extraordinary day.
They were in Austria, and during the war, he had three different lieutenants that were responsible for his group, and unfortunately, all three of them had been killed in the war. And they had offered my father an opportunity to get a field promotion as an officer, and he smugly turned it down and said, "No, you know, those people have a tendency to get killed. I'm just going to stay a sergeant because my guys and I get along just fine." And he had a platoon of 23, and on the morning of May 5th, he was given the responsibility to go and check the quality of the bridges going into right on the border of Austria there, where the American Army and the Russian armies were going to ultimately meet up, and that's where they were going to divide Europe. And so when he got up in the morning on May 5th, he was told to take his armored car and his little tank and take his 23 men through and just check the bridges so that they could make sure that the troops could get through safely.
Hmm. At some point, he received information, disturbing information, which sort of prompted him to, in a sense, change course with his platoon. Tell us who crossed his path and the kind of information that they were sharing with your father.
Yes. When he first got into the town of Lunitz, I believe, he saw what was looked to be a small factory. And there, one of his men saw a German officer, German soldier on the hill with a weapon. And my dad stopped his men and was going to call in for artillery cover. And the fellow came down, and he surrendered. And so he called off the artillery barrage, and the fellow took him to a small camp, which turned out to be the Gusen camp. And the Nazis had turned it over to the Austrian Guard. And in this camp, they had, it was like the sister camp of Mauthausen, and there were maybe about 1,800 people in this camp. And the Austrian Guard immediately surrendered, and he asked for their weapons, and they were going to move on. And the guards there had said to him, let us keep our weapons because that's the only way we're going to be able to keep peace here. We promise we're not going to shoot anybody. The Americans are now under control, but, let us have this until you could bring in people here to, safely take the prisoners out. So he reluctantly agreed to do that. And then he was on his mission to check the bridges, and they saw a white car coming down the road, and it was an old German vehicle that was painted white and with a red cross on it. And a fellow from the Red Cross in this vehicle had two Nazi soldiers, SS, and another civilian, and told my dad that he would like him to go up to this Mauthausen, this larger camp, because there were several thousand people there. Well, he called in to his officers and explained, what he had found in Goose, and they said, "Okay, stand back. Your mission is to go on and continue to check the bridges. No, we don't want you to go any further up the road to this other camp." At this point, the fellow from the Red Cross begged him to keep going because, as he explained, that in the camp they had run out of the deadly gas, And Himmler had given orders to destroy any and all evidence of this very prolific death camp. We later come to find that approximately 1,100 people a day were killed at Mauthausen. So when he asked what the plans were, they had explained that there was a cave, and Himmler had requested that all the prisoners be put into this cave, and then they were going to blow up the cave and destroy, you know, all the evidence. So when he heard this, he talked to his men and said, it looks like we're going to deny orders. And he said to himself, fat chance that we're going to let these people die. And he and his 23 men went forward into Mauthausen.
Mm. Ahead of describing what they found, was this, as far as you're concerned, consistent with who your father was? Or was this, in a sense, a departure from what he would typically have done? I mean, was he typically a man who followed orders, no questions asked, or was this in keeping with the kind of man that he was?
He would follow orders to the T. You know, even if, you know, in most cases, you know, even if he disagreed, he'd follow orders and then argue about it later. This was certainly an unusual act.
Right, and that in some ways makes it an even more powerful act that. That he was acting, in a sense, against probably a lot of his own instincts and what experience had taught him. He was following, another voice at this point. So describe what happened from there.
So when they get to the camp, most of his men stayed outside. They saw this huge facility with cannons popping out of every hole. They had no idea what they were going to find when they went into the first gate. And there was electrified fencing. So he went in with just two of his men, and the others stayed outside. And when he went in, the place, you know, basically, so he's with his armored vehicle and his tank, and they go in, and the place erupts into a riot. One of the things that was unusual, since they were in the 11th Armored Division, their symbol was lightning bolts, dual lightning bolts, and many of the prisoners thought it was SS because of the similarity of the symbol.
Hmm.
But fortunately, in the camp, There was a prisoner by the name of Lieutenant Jack Taylor, who was an American Navy pilot that had been shot down, and he was in that camp and had been scheduled to be killed several times. And other prisoners, you know, took his place in line when they marched him into the ovens. Taylor explained to the people that, you know, these are Americans, and the German officer, you know, immediately, you know, surrendered to him. But he said he wouldn't really surrender unless he could stop the rioting. Now, because my dad was of Polish descent and his parents, you know, spoke Polish at home, he was able to speak Polish, and because there were so many Polish-speaking prisoners in the camp, he was able to capture their attention. And then there was rioting going on in the kitchens because, obviously, they were going after any kind of food that they could get because they had been starved for so long. And he ended up having to climb through a window and shot his pistol in the air to get their attention and told them that he would definitely, you know, take care of them, that they were, you know, now the responsibility of the American Army. The German officer said he would only surrender to an American general, and my dad convinced him that he was a direct link to Patton.
Hmm.
And so they surrendered, and he did get control of the people there. And then there were 45 countries that were actually represented in the, or 35 countries that were represented in that camp.
Amongst the prisoners?
Yes. And what Lieutenant Taylor did, he got each of the spokespeople for each of the different countries there, and they met with him, and he, you know, told them, you know, over about an hour period of time that you know, they were going to be safe, that the Americans were there to help them. And in the meantime, his other 21 fellows were outside the camp. They had no idea what was going on, and the lieutenant that was responsible for them, Lieutenant Larkin, kept calling in on the radio, you know, where are you, what's going on, and they had no idea. They couldn't tell them. They said they're inside this factory. They don't know what's going on. So then after the he met with each of the countries, this Lieutenant Taylor had, because about 2 days prior, he saw American planes flying over, and he told everyone that it was going to be very soon before the American soldiers would come in and liberate them. They, you know, he was very confident that the Americans were close because he saw the planes. And they had some instruments in the camp, and he, musical instruments, and he taught the prisoners how to play the national anthem. And after my dad met with all of them, they played the national anthem, and he said forever that song had a special meaning to him. It was just unbelievable.
Wow, that's amazing. Larry Kosiak, recalling the events of May 5th, 1945, when his father, Albert Kosiak, led his platoon of 23 Americans in the liberation of the Munthausen prison camp. Larry Kosiak and other special guests will be joining best-selling author Wendy Holden on Saturday morning, May 15th, at the Lake Geneva Public Library. Today, the 5th of May, is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and I'm thinking back to some of the memorable and poignant conversations I have been privileged to have on this program with various Holocaust survivors. Among the most memorable conversations is that of a woman by the name of Edith Eisenberg, who lived for many years in Racine, a beloved member of the community. And I will never forget the experience of speaking with her, not only about her family's very narrow escape from Germany, but also about the way in which she spoke so movingly of the years spent here in America as they sought to rebuild their lives and write a new chapter for themselves.
I began to realize very shortly how extremely fortunate I was that my parents and I could have come to the United States. And I became very patriotic. I wanted to do everything I could to help the war effort, like knitting for the Red Cross and saving tinfoil, all those things. And of course, my parents watched the news, listened to the news daily. I mean, the radio was always on for every little bit of news. And we didn't know what had happened to my grandparents and other relatives. So my father was always searching for ways to maybe find out some of that information.
Were you ever able to receive any sort of letters from them after you had departed?
Between the time we departed and the war started, we received a letter every week.
Really?
From my grandparents. A long letter from my grandfather and a shorter note from my grandmother. And these letters are, I always looked at them as the Anne Frank diary of a aging couple. That is how I saw them. At that time, I read the letters. I was happy that, you know, they wrote. I was always mentioned in them. But then as I got older, and especially, and I started when I was in high school, when I read these letters, they broke my heart. And I can barely read them. I always wanted to translate them for my children into English, but I still haven't been able to do it. They are the it's a group of letters where every week you see a little bit more hope being lost, a little bit more despair.
As their situation worsens,
and as they begin to realize, and I think in the last letters you can really tell that they knew what was ahead of them.
Wow.
And my father compiled, he saved all the letters, he wrote an introduction to these letters, and he gave them to the Leo Beck Institute. That's a archive for German Jewish history in New York City, and they have offices in London. And now they have an office in Germany, and I think they have the largest collection of German Jewish history. And he gave it to them in their memory.
And you have these letters also.
I have copies. The originals are at the Leo Beck Institute, and I have the copies.
At one point, did the letters simply stop arriving? I mean, is that when essentially you knew something had happened?
Well, the letters stopped arriving the minute that the United States entered the war.
Ah. At what point did you ultimately learn about their fate? Was that not until the war was over?
We actually got two letters, short notifications through the American Red Cross from the concentration camp that they were in. They were in Theresienstadt, Terrassen.
Yes.
And that was, well, the Germans had really designated that as a model camp. They would show that camp off to visitors, or when the American Red Cross, not the International Red Cross, would come, they could in no time beautify it and have it look like it was really a not so bad a place to be.
I have a compact disc recording of music that was composed by people at Theresienstadt, and things that were even presentations that would be made sometimes when Red Cross workers would come.
Right.
And it is so poignant to listen to that music, and both to think about somebody writing music in the face of all that. And also it's sad to think about some of that music in a sense being twisted into propaganda.
Exactly. I don't know. Do you know the book, I'll Never See Another Butterfly?
Sure.
That's from Theresienstadt. Mm. And it was beautiful, poignant children's poems that were written during that time.
Yeah. So you did know something then of your grandparents' fate. When was it that you learned ultimately of their death?
There were only the letters that came. There were just two or three lines. And what we all noticed is my grandfather was extremely proud of his handwriting. He had a beautiful handwriting. And when the letters came, we saw that the deterioration in his handwriting.
Mm.
And then the last letter that came, it said, please, we are fine. Please do not worry about us. And we hope you are fine. And that was it.
Wow.
And I have those letters at home. Then after the war ended, we found out that they had died, the dates of their death and how they died of starvation. We found that out because my father was able, the lists became available. Lists became available with names of people who had survived. And my father went through that list and he found a couple of names, people he thought my grandparents might have gotten to know while they were in Theresienstadt, because they were from the same vicinity or they were distant relatives. And he contacted them. And then that was the first time that he knew for sure. And then after a while, we were able to find out from the German government and then from the Czechoslovakian government, because Theresienstadt is in Czechoslovakia. And they had very, very accurate records. And I guess one thing you can say, they were methodical. The records show that. It showed the date, the time of when they were deported, where they were deported from. Everyone assigned a number. And so we were very fortunate because we were able, through these people who knew my grandparents at the concentration camp, to learn a little bit more about them and what they had been doing And one of the things that really touched me, my grandfather during the First World War was a, there's a German name, but it's like a medic.
Huh.
Because there was a base hospital in Bensheim where they lived, and he was there taking care of German soldiers who were returned to that hospital. And then when he was in Theresienstadt, the last thing he did until he died, he again was a medic, and he took care.
Really?
Yeah.
There at the camp?
At the camp. And this one lady wrote that how kind he was to all these people, dying people.
I think it must be so interesting for you all these years later to be looking back at these events and looking back at them, I should think, differently. I mean, to experience them at the time as still, you know, a young person, and then as your life proceeds, as you marry, as you have children, to still, of course, be thinking about your grandparents and remembering this heartache, but seeing it differently, through the eyes of an adult.
And then also, I understood what actually happened because I read so many books on the Holocaust. Mm. And went to lectures on the Holocaust, that I learned to look at it from a different view. One, I had the emotional view for a long, long time.
And nothing else.
And nothing else. Mm. And I think going back to Germany that was a hard decision. I always thought I would never go back. But my husband really wanted to go back, and I was so glad that I decided to go with him. I think it was, in many ways, healing. I don't believe in the word closure. There is no closure for something like that. But I have many friends in Germany now. I love the young people.
Hmm.
I think they're wonderful. We've had them come and stay with us, and we really have some pretty close ties over there.
Hmm. And were you able to reconnect with people that you had known, for instance, in Stuttgart?
I wasn't able to reconnect with anybody in Stuttgart. And in Bensheim, I was able to reconnect with people who, I was able to reconnect with people that knew me when I was a little girl.
Right, who remembered you, even if you probably didn't remember them.
And friends of my grandparents. I got to know several of my father's gymnasium professors, which was my father, because of his writings, having been a writer and an editor, was very well known.
Mm.
And people were interested in meeting his daughter.
I could see why. Here in America, you go through school. You, I assume, graduate from high school. And what happens to you from there?
I graduated from high school, and I went on to nursing school. After that, I met my husband. We were married, and we moved to Saratoga Springs, New York, after he graduated, after he got his master's degree. We moved to Saratoga Springs, New York, where he taught at Skidmore, and he went on to get his PhD from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We had four children, and eventually when he went to do a postdoctoral in Madison, and we decided to come to, Kenosha, and my husband was the first chair of the science division there.
At the University of Wisconsin Parkside.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned the fact that for a long time you didn't talk much about this, that it was really, it sounds like you were following your husband's lead in some respects in sharing about this. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah. He talked about it more than I did. I think No, but because he left Germany in 1936, he didn't have the trauma the same way that I did.
Right.
But by talking to him and by talking to other people, I became more willing. I really felt I had to trust someone in order to speak to them about what happened. And until, like I said, I saw the necessity of really being a witness to what happened.
As you raised your four children, how much would you talk about this with them?
That's a real interesting question, because there's so many Holocaust survivors didn't talk to their children at all.
Really?
Some didn't even know they were Holocaust children of Holocaust survivors. Hmm. But I was used to talking. My father talked to me, and he wrote about the Holocaust, and that's because he was a writer. And so it was just natural for me to talk to my children about it. And they, from day one, knew what had happened to their families in the Holocaust. I think that, I don't think it affected their life in it. We didn't frighten them with it. We just told them the facts. We told them how important our heritage was to us, and that we hoped it would be important to them. And then we took them on a trip to Germany and showed them where Norbert's family had come from, where I had come from, and they met some of these people I told you in Bensheim that that had known my parents and had known me as a child. And we visited the cemeteries, and we try to do a family tree. We try to trace back our ancestry to as long as we can, could. And our children were different, of course, were different ages when we took them, and they responded differently to it. To one of our children, it was just a great vacation. Very, very excited about it. One of our other children did not think it was right for us to go back to Germany. Mm. Another son became very, very interested in the Holocaust, and he became a history major, actually.
Wow.
And he's probably read every book on the Holocaust that's available. But I think, in general, I think our children knew how grateful we were to be in this country. They knew how Norbert and I were thankful every day of our life, really, that we were spared. And I think that was transmitted to them, because they have a great interest in this country. They have historical interest in what's going on in the world, and they've even passed some of that on to my grandchildren.
A portion of a long conversation recorded for the morning show a number of years ago with Holocaust survivor Edith Eisenberg. Tonight at 6:30 p.m. at Kenosha's Civil War Museum, there is a presentation to be given by Holocaust survivor Ray David. This event is free and open to the public. 6:30 p.m. at Kenosha's Civil War Museum. I'm Gregory Berg. Thank you. a portion of the set.